Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. My name's Jack Pelling and with me is Robin Allender. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jack.
Happy Beatle Christmas.
Is it Christmas?
Well, it is for Beatles fans.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, of course. It's better than Christmas. It's bigger than Christmas.
Yeah, it's bigger than Christmas.
It is, yeah.
So not only do we have a fantastic episode coming up with Adam Buxton, which we're very excited about, today also sees the release of Peter Jackson's long-awaited epic, Get Back, which we're going to talk about a little bit because we've had the massive pleasure of being able to dig into it already. But firstly, a little bit about our interview with Adam, which was really exciting, someone we've wanted to get on for ages. So yeah, it was really, really great to have him on and it was a fantastic chat.
Yeah, it was... And very flattering to think that he's listened in to it as well. And he liked the jingles.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that's the biggest compliment you can get, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the artwork and the jingles and stuff is very, very specific.
Yeah,
actually cut out all of the flattering parts because I thought it might make us look big-headed. But it's lovely that Adam is a fan of the podcast and stuff. So a brilliant way to sort of tying up 2021. And there's loads of fantastic chat about in there about not only his sort of personal Beatles journey, but we talk about, you know, him interviewing Paul, obviously. Mm. And we talk a lot about sharing a Beatles relationship with your parents or whatever and sort of trying to bridge generational gaps and stuff like that with the Beatles and other kinds of music, which is really fascinating actually.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously you're talking about his dad, Bad Dad, as you may know him as from the Adam and Joe show, and then talking about Adam's relationship with his own children, who one of whom is a big Beatles fan now as well. It was just a great chat. He was so lovely. It was really interesting as well, like, because he talked about this thing of, and it's a really important thing, but it's for maybe a generation slightly above us, but remembering the Beatles singles being in the charts. Mm-hmm. And Wendy Erskine mentioned this as well in a bit that I didn't include in the chat, but it was 1976 when the singles were reissued. And can you believe there was a week in April where 23 of the top 100 singles were Beatles songs.
In 1976?
Yeah.
Of all times.
Of all times. So, which included Yesterday, which was never released as a single in the UK. And so I think that's something that we've never really talked about, but has obviously had a huge impact on kind of Beatles fans of a certain generation to remember them as, you know, a contemporary band, really, because of those singles being kind of inescapable at that period, you know.
And another thing that's weirdly come up twice in a row is Stars on 45.
I know, yeah.
So we talked quite in depth about that.
I mean, the first time I heard Stars on 45, again, was slightly too young for it, but I remember being at a wedding and just thinking, what the fuck is this? Like, I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't believe how weird it was. But yeah, that's come up a couple of times.
Yeah. And speaking of the Adam and Joe show, Adam also talked about the time that he interviewed Ray Manzarek, the keyboard player of The Doors, for a section of their show called Vinyl Justice, in particular Ray talking about Rubber Soul. And Adam was very kind enough to give us the audio rushes for that interview. So we've got some never heard before, I don't think, extras from that interview with Ray Manzarek, where he talks about hanging out with the Beatles and Rubber Soul and stuff. So that's really worth listening. It's amazing.
Sure. It's a shame in a way, though, because Adam's impression of him was really good as well. And also you get to hear, which you may have already heard already, because if you're a fan of Adam Buxton, but Adam Buxton's fantastic version of How Do You Sleep, which is which is really something.
Yeah, it's absolutely superb.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's so funny.
And speaking of impressions from the good to the ugly, we also reenact a little bit of the 2000 TV movie The Two of Us, starring Aidan Quinn and Jared Harris, where you know, in an offcut from a planned segment that Adam was going to do with Paul, I got Paul Sloppy Seconds and do my best at impersonating him.
I think you did a good job
with Adam and doing John. Yeah, I mean, it's not the worst Paul McCartney impression we've had on this podcast. I really wouldn't want to take that torch from Pictures Trail. But, but it's well worth a listen for fans of terrible accents, which, yeah, there's also some good fun at the end with some scatological Beatles titles. Yeah. And it was just a terrific. There's so much to dig into. It's going to be quite a long episode, but, you know, this week, we probably don't have time for any correspondence. We'll save that for the next one. But we can't really do a Beatles podcast coming out today without talking a little bit about Get Back.
Yeah, so there's a lot to digest.
There is. And I should say from the off that my immediate reaction in seeing this and knowing that we were going to talk about it on the day it comes out is that I really don't want to do a sort of spoilerific deep dive into that. I think we'll save that for another day, because part of the joy of it is just being the constant string of surprises and little beautiful little moments. So I'm not going to ruin any of that, but we'll talk about it in sort of quite broad terms.
And so feel free to skip if you know,
And if you're here just if you don't want to hear any of that until you've seen the whole thing, or you're just an Adam Buxton fan and you don't know who we are and you want to, you know, skip all this blithering, then go about 15 minutes in and you know, you'll save yourself a bit of time. We should say it's 9 hours long and we only got the episode a few days ago, so I haven't had time to watch the whole thing. I'm about halfway through episode 3, which is about 7 hours in, and you've just seen the first one.
Yeah,
but that's still a good stint.
Oh yeah.
But I think it, you know, I don't want to speak for you, but it's absolutely extraordinary.
I mean, a guest we've got coming up on the show likened the fact to of this almost magical experience of, I don't know if any of you've had this experience of hearing a voicemail from someone who's died or something like that, but there is that kind of just amazing feeling of these are people who you know so well, for not know personally, but you know so well from their music, and you're seeing their lives in extraordinary detail, from the newspapers they're reading to the TV they watched the night before, to the songs they've been listening to their way of learning and writing and collaborating and arguing and laughing.
Yeah.
In all that and having tea and drinking lovely, what looks like a lovely glass of beer.
Yes. The pale ale, please, Mal.
So it's, for me, the first thing was that extraordinary level of detail. You can smell the fag smoke. And I don't know if you've ever done a session like that, if you've played in a band and rehearsed for long periods like that, but it's, I had that feeling of like your ears ringing after having amps on all day kind of thing. It's got that kind of sense of the frustrations, which, you know, we're all familiar with from the Let It Be film sessions and everything, but that kind of feeling of sitting around not knowing what to do and stuff. I remember once playing in a band where it was like, you know, we were just jamming away, having this stupid jam for ages, and the manager came in and turned all the amps off and said, do you know how much this is costing us? But like, there's something of that with this where it's just like, there's no plan. There's absolutely no plan. And it's just that kind of, waiting for things to come together is the kind of extraordinary thing to it.
I mean, it's sort of, as I said to you yesterday, the overarching feeling of it is that this is an absolutely terrible idea from the beginning. But yeah, as you say, I mean, I think it's what I found absolutely incredible is, you know, these people are probably the most, you know, well-documented people, certainly of that era. And I have seen hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of footage with them. But just being so close to them and it being so candid, and just the fact that it's really taking its time to sort of follow them around. You know, there's no montages. There's no sort of one of them saying, oh, we should get a keyboard player, and then cutting to Billy Preston walk in. Like, all of these decisions are all being made in kind of real time.
Yeah.
And because of that, they've never felt so tangible.
Yes.
And you completely feel like you're in the room with them. And as you say, like that thing of that ringing in your ears, I felt like I was getting tired when they were getting tired.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I was getting annoyed with certain members when other people were rubbing each other up the wrong way and stuff. And I was so emotionally invested in it because it's almost in real time.
Yeah.
And you know them so well already. It's like watching, like that only, I mean, I remember talking about this with Jeff Lloyd, but it's like, it's, you know, a bit of a sort of well-worn point, but it is like watching four siblings or four old friends who've known each other for sort of 20 years, and especially in that first episode you know sort of broadly where it's going because you know it's in three parts, and I don't think it's giving anything away to say that episode one is sort of Twickenham, which we all know doesn't end superbly. Episode two is Savile Row, and episode three is sort of the build-up and then the rooftop sort of concert. So there's a really good sort of three-act structure in setting it out like that. And I was quite cynical, maybe because of Peter Jackson's previous of extending things that really didn't need to be extended. But I think it's actually a brilliant decision because the pace allows you to just completely immerse yourself in the world and get sort of really sucked into it. And, you know, there's one particular bit where I think, you know, everyone knows that George walks out, but just how devastating it is for especially Paul is a moment when he's like, and then there were two, and when they're wondering who's going to turn up to work the next day and stuff. It's just absolutely amazing.
Well, I mean, the dynamic between Paul and George is absolutely fascinating, really, because you're siding with George so much, because again, we don't want to go into like too much detail here. I'm sure we will at some point down the line, but like George bringing in songs and Paul more or less ignoring him, you know, and you can see this magnetic chemistry when they're in the mood between Paul and John, and George is kind of such an outsider from that. And if you're thinking like he's been with these people for so many years, and you know, he's probably had to deal with that exact dynamic so many times that you feel his frustration and you get that real insight into it. And the other fascinating thing about George, I think, is he's one of those musicians where he's always like comparing himself to other people. There's Dylan, there's Clapton. He'd obviously just been hanging out with Dylan. And like when he's playing the guitar, it's like he's trying wah and he's trying tremolo. Mm-hmm. And it's like he can just never quite relax into it. There's this footage I'm sure I can remember seeing of him playing on a US tour with the Beatles. You know, it must have been 64, 65 or something. And between every kind of bit he's playing on the guitar, he's checking the volume control on his guitar to check it's turned up all the way. And there's that neurosis to George, which I think comes across so well, like in a situation where he kind of has no voice because Paul is dominating so much that like he resorts to this negativity so much. You know, that's an insane idea. You know, there's a lot of that, you know, and it's like...
And part of him is him being sort of the pragmatist as well. But, you know, again, I'm a little bit further ahead than you. So what is fascinating is to see how quickly that gets patched up as soon as they're out of that toxic place. And you need it after part one, let me tell you. Because it's emotionally exhausting. And then as soon as you get there, it's pretty much joy all the way.
You said as soon as the Rosewood telly
comes
out.
Well, that's it. And I was kind of joking when I said that. But actually, there is a lot in what you say about him playing the Cherry Les Paul.
Which is my favourite ever guitar. The heartbreaking moment where it falls over.
And no one gives a shit.
I
literally went... just watch it fall over. But I mean, because you know it's Clapton's guitar and stuff, and it is him trying to play, and there are bits where he's like, you know, it needs to sound more like Clapton or whatever, and it's like, no, it's you're very good, George. just be you. I think give that that getting that guitar in, and then obviously we see sort of Billy Preston arrive and stuff. It's just, I think once we've watched it all and had a bit of time to digest, but it's a couple of things that I would like to flag. First, We never really seen that much of Michael Lindsay-Hogg in the original documentary.
Yeah,
he's completely mad.
I love him. I mean, can he's I say fantastic. The bit that really made me laugh is when they're thinking about where to do this gig, and he suggests doing it in an orphanage.
Well, first he says a hospital, and then he's like, yeah. "Well, but not a horrible hospital, you know, a hospital with like kids with broken legs."
Yeah, he's very strange. Yeah.
An orphanage.
Really, yeah, strange guy. I think it's lovely seeing the relationship with Mal Evans, particularly Long and Winding Road, where Paul is just bouncing ideas off him and he's contributing, you know, because Mal Evans was writing the lyrics down to distribute to people. He was such a, you know, as well as banging on the anvil, which we see in Let It Be as well. But
there's a bit where George is like, "Mal, can you get me a purple dicky bow tie?" Yeah. And he's like, "Yeah, sure." He's like, "What the hell? How are you supposed to do that?" But that's the lovely thing about all these sort of like satellite characters popping in and out, like Mal, and then there's also this slightly sort of weird charlatan called Magic Alex. Who I didn't know that much about. He sort of waves in and out of the old one, but he turns up with these like absolutely awful prototypes, and was obviously responsible for building the first desk, which is completely shit,
rubbish.
Didn't work.
And there's that great story about Magic Alex where he part of his kind of goal to create an 8-track mixing desk involved putting 8 speakers in Savile Row as if each track needs its own speaker. But but that's a great bit I loved about, because they're obsessed with getting it to 8 tracks at this stage. And there's a great bit Paul McCartney says, it's really, "I know for a fact the Beach Boys have got 8 tracks." It's really Partridge. "Yeah, I know for a fact Martin Lewis got 2 power showers out of them." One for him, one for his brother-in-law. But I love that. It's brilliant. And we haven't talked about Ringo.
No, I mean, Ringo is he's relatively taciturn.
He is. And John Harris in an interview said the thing that surprised him when he was going through all the, you know, he was transcribing the conversations, was how quiet Ringo was and how miserable he seemed. But I think Ringo is, well, A, I've never met a drummer who knows when to shut up as much as him.
Yeah, yeah.
If you ever practiced with a band, you know, the drummer is just playing along and, you know, just, but Ringo just absolutely knows exactly his role, which is not to demean him at all, or to diminish his role, but like, and one just wonderful bit where Paul says, you know, "If it comes to it, I'll do it on my own," or something. But Ringo says something like, "I could watch him play the piano all day," or something.
Yeah,
and it's just such
a
sweet moment because he knows what he's in this with these incredible people. And he knows his role as a drummer. And it's just like, he's just so fantastically stoical. And I think he's full of good humor in it.
Yeah.
And it's very much warts and all because he's got a terrible spot at one point, hasn't it? But for these moments, which just feel like just incredible sacred moments, there is just an incredible bit, which is the birth of the song Get Back, which is probably the outstanding moment from episode 1, really.
It's like a conjuring trick.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're doing it in a biopic and you're like, for fuck's sake, people don't write songs like
that. Yes, exactly. But Paul is so guileless about the way he composes. I've never seen anyone like that. I mean, I don't know why I would see many people like that. But for me, songwriting seems such a kind of private endeavor. But for him, it's this kind of performative thing.
Yeah.
He can't he can't help write songs. He just sits down at the piano and they just come out, you know.
And when he turns up, he's got so many, and he sort of, in a slightly barbed way, he says to John, like, "Have you only come with like 2 songs or whatever?"
Yeah.
He's like, "I work best when my back's against the wall."
Yeah,
But the amount of stuff that, especially when things aren't going so well, and he just sits down and plays, you know, things that are going to be on, you know, albums, 2 or 3 albums in the future.
Yeah. Another Day is one of the ones.
It's pouring out of him. Mm-hmm. And then once the dynamic gets all nice again, and they go into sort of creative overdrive, that is when the foot really goes down on the gas and you start seeing some real magic. And once they get into Savile Row and things start to click, you can see everyone getting excited about it, mm-hmm. including sort of George Martin. And it's a bit where George Martin says to George, he's like, you know, just everyone looks so happy. It's so good to see you all bouncing off each other again. And you can see he's so, it would have been a mistake to have gone and all of this stuff. And yeah, it's just, it's an absolutely, it will fundamentally change my relationship with the band. I really believe that. Because it's just so, you've seen them in such a different light. And I think the overarching thing for me was just, I absolutely fell in love with John again in a way that I haven't for, you know, sort of 10 years. He's just such a, there's nothing sort of abrasive about him in this film. There's nothing sort of spiky. He's really matter of fact. He's actually the most self-aware and diplomatic one where when Paul is getting a bit sort of bolshy and annoying, he's the one who sort of calms things down and he's brutally honest. And, you know, the, and you could just, he just feels like the most mature one in the room, which I would have guessed from what I knew about those sessions that, you know, his heart wasn't really in it, but you know, he's as desperate to make it work as Paul is.
Yeah.
And he is in love with the Beatles as much as Paul is. And, you know, these are all sort of cliches that Paul has said, you know, is the beauty of this film, but it really, really comes across. And, yeah, it made me, I got quite emotional watching it. I knew I would. It's no surprise to anyone, but just watching him and the moments where, because they're kind of semi-aware there's a camera there.
Yeah.
But the moments that him and Paul get together and they're just sort of, even the way that they diffuse an argument is done in a way that you can only do with a family member or someone that you've known for such a long time, because they're sort of tacitly apologizing to each other without saying the words. And they just have this complete unspoken connection. And sort of knowing what happened after that, it's just, I find it absolutely, it's so heartbreaking, especially because we've seen Paul in the flesh talk about that and stuff recently. But my, so far, I've got a couple of hours left to go, but I think it's going to, it's sort of as important as the anthology is going to be.
Yeah.
Sort of level of importance.
For a generation, yeah, for sure. Do you think there will be people who think it's kind of taken some of the magic away by seeing them this up close?
I would have said that when I was one episode in.
Right, yeah.
And I'm not saying that just because I'm one episode ahead of you, but I really, when I finished part one, and we should say that they're very keen to stress for these early reviews that we don't interview in parts, so sorry, we kind of have done that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to, they want to think of it as one big project.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I did feel after the first act, shall we call it, very sort of deflated and emotionally kind of exhausted and like, oh, I don't know if I really wanted to see that. It's like, you know, parents or couples that have split up, you don't want to be in the kitchen with them when it's happening.
You got to, as well, and it's a point Ian McDonald makes, is they were almost surprised by how bad it sounded in Twickenham. As in, they're not playing together brilliantly at the start, you know, and some of Paul's ideas, like when they're doing Don't Let Me Down, you know, and they're doing this middle, they're working on the bridge, and Paul's suggesting these backing vocals and just really steamrolling it. And it's like, Paul, that's such a shit idea. And obviously they don't end up doing it, but you can see, you know, that it's not quite.
And he's desperately trying to wrestle control and like, and it's anything productive from these sessions that everyone can see is a fucking nightmare. And to be fair, George is the one who's like, there's nothing's good is going to come of this.
Yeah.
Fuck it. Yeah, see you around the clubs.
See you around the clubs. Yeah. I mean, yeah, but obviously, yeah, I'm coming at from it from the perspective of just that, you know, act one. So yeah.
Yeah, but I would say all of that sort of dissipated when you see, as I say, when Billy Preston and the Rosewood Telly turn up and, you know, George's one background, it just becomes the documentary it was meant to be. I think we've probably said enough for now.
Sure, yeah. I mean, we've got another episode coming up next week, so we'll probably chat about it a bit more. But I think maybe around Christmas we'll do an episode where we talk about it more at length because we've had time to digest it, you know. What do you think, Jack?
Yeah, I think so. It's going to be, it's definitely going to be one I'm already looking forward to watching again. So it sounds good to me. But yeah, so we won't keep you any longer in this extended episode. But if you've fast forwarded, you can stop fast forwarding now because it's time for Adam Buxton's Personal Beatles. So this week, Robin and I are absolutely delighted to welcome to the podcast Adam Buxton. Hi, Adam. How are you?
Hello, Jack. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
All well?
Good to meet you guys. All's well, thank you. Yes, I'm very happy to be here. I'm alive. All the members of my family are currently alive. And my dog, Rosie, is in good shape. So nothing to complain
Amazing.
About.
Amazing. You're obviously a massive music fan and a big Beatles man. But where does your sort of... We both read your book and there's loads of stuff about your sort of formative musical experience in that. But the Beatles are kind of not really mentioned in there, but has it always been a bit of a constant for you?
I think so. I think Bowie kind of dominated my musical enthusiasms when I was younger, and I felt as if I was the most... I was the biggest Bowie fan in the room. Whereas my best friend, one of my best friends, Patrick Dickey, when we were young, he was one of the first people that I knew who was a passionate music fan. And he was uber Beatles nerd.
Yeah.
In a way that was quite intimidating. I didn't know anyone else who was that passionate about music.
And in the book, you talk about you were 10 when John Lennon was murdered.
Yeah.
And Patrick was profoundly affected by it, and you almost couldn't believe his reaction. Was that right?
Yeah, big style. We were at boarding school together at that point, and I remember being in the dormitory, and it was quite a big dormitory, so about 30 or 40 boys up there. And and it was the day that John Lennon had been shot, and everyone was talking about it. Evidently, there were a few people who were Beatles fans, but they were also the sport fans, right? So that was a world that I wasn't even part of. I just thought, oh, those guys play football. So I don't care about anything that they're into, including the Beatles, whoever they are. I mean, I think I knew who the Beatles were by that point, sort of, but not really. And I did not know that John Lennon was one of the Beatles even. So when they were all talking about this guy who'd been shot, oh, Lennon's been shot. Oh, my God. And my friend Patrick, actually, we weren't friends at that point, but Patrick was, I think, maybe even crying. And it was weird because he was kind of a hard guy. He was tough and he was intelligent and into sport and basically the opposite of me. And it was strange to see him so upset. And I just said, like, what is the big deal about this hippie dying? Like, who cares, really? And so he went absolutely nuts and had to be restrained by some of the other sport guys. But I really didn't get it. And I had, I have a clear memory of thinking then, but not having the terminology, that it was very performative. You know, I just thought, these guys are signaling. There's a lot of signaling going on here. And I don't know. This is bullshit. You know what I mean? They're 10. They don't know who John Lennon was. And why do they care if he's been shot? You know, like, who would have upset me if they'd been shot? I don't know, Russ Abbott. But,
so you're saying it was like the kind of 1980 equivalent of people saying, God, I can't believe this happened. I was in Paris 6 months ago. You know, that kind of thing after that.
Just the idea that you would be so personally affected by someone you'd never met. A bit like all the... And there's always people who still feel like that. You know, after Bowie died and there was an outpouring of grief on the internet, there was also a strong backlash from certain quarters saying, get over yourselves, you know, who cares? You never met the guy. This is pathetic. You know, grow a pair, et cetera, et cetera. And... I think I was in that camp when Lennon was killed, I'm sad to say.
When Bowie died, though, did you get a bit grief-possessive with people who were quite performative? when he died, because there seemed to be a big thing about, you didn't love him like I loved him.
Yeah. No, not really, because I've never been one of those guys. I mean, I felt a kinship with people who were upset. I stayed away from some of the more performatively grief-stricken ones, but there were lots of people on there sharing stories about Bowie that I found very comforting, because my dad had died 5 weeks before as well. So I was still in that morbid zone. And then when Bowie died, it kind of gave a bit of shape to some of the feelings I hadn't been able to express about my dad. And then reading people's recollections of encounters they'd had with Bowie, sharing clips of strange things that he'd done on TV, interviews that I'd never seen before, I found that tremendously comforting to see other people's perspectives, you know.
Yeah, I remember that. I think two of the photos that were kind of side by side on my social media, one was Pat Metheny, the jazz guitarist, who recorded a song with David Bowie. And the next one was Tricky. And it's you couldn't think of two more different people. And that kind of seemed to sum up the kind of range of his influence and connections and things.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everyone had lots of strange little stories. But then for me, Beatles-wise, Patrick never converted me. He, I think, realized that I was resistant to the whole thing. And actually, he was a big Bowie fan as well. So we bonded over Bowie. Mm. But then earlier than that, I'd been exposed to the Beatles as just this kind of enjoyably strange, anomalous cultural phenomenon via my parents in the early 70s. Because my parents were friends with these people who were a bit more trendy than they were. Both my mum and dad were quite conservative in almost every way. But my mum was about 15 years younger than my dad. So so she was a bit more open-minded. And when we went to stay with these people in Scotland, they were a bit groovy and a bit younger than my dad. But my dad wanted to impress them because they were quite posh. And it was a world that my dad was keen to be a part of. And they played Sergeant Pepper in the lounge while the kids fooled around. And they had a playroom. I'd never been to a house with a playroom, like a dedicated playroom. And it was a big old room as well. And they had Mousetrap. I'd never seen Mousetrap before the game. So I was trying to assemble Mousetrap. And then I every now and again would wander in to see what mum and dad were doing in the big room. And everyone was smoking and drinking booze, even though it was the afternoon, and laughing and laughing. And the soundtrack was Sergeant Pepper. And I'd never heard grown-ups playing that kind of music before. My dad was a Wagner guy. You know, if it was party time for my dad, then maybe you get a bit of Glenn Miller or maybe Ella Fitzgerald, you know, that's about as groovy as my dad got. Mum was more of a pop fan, and she'd liked the Beatles when she was younger, but never really got a chance to play them at home, I don't think, because my dad sort of dominated the stereo. And to hear that music was so interesting to me that grown-ups listen to this. Wow. And Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds made a big impression, because I just thought, this is fun. This is like fun music. It's easily likable. It's not a nursery rhyme, but it has elements that are, you know, it has elements in common with kind of nursery rhymes, but it's weird and interesting. And then I remember looking at the cover of Sergeant Pepper and being intrigued by that as well. And then later on in the 70s, it was the Christmas screenings of the Beatles movies that I think were always on BBC Two, weren't they? Or is that just my imagination? Throughout the 70s, Christmas TV was characterized by screenings of Bond movies, and this is late 70s, I guess, early 80s, and Beatles movies. And I have clear memories of watching some of the Beatles movies with my mum and feeling Christmassy and excited, and also just thinking that it was, again, a weird kind of anomaly in the culture, because they were funny and they were weird. And in those days, there was quite a clear delineation, as far as I was concerned anyway, between straight grown-up culture, the news, grown-up programs, things like that, all of which were more or less totally devoid of humor. And then there was comedy, sitcoms, etc. Are You Being Served, etc., things like that, you know. It Ain't Half Hot, Mum, totally beyond the pale, things that you couldn't watch now, that we used to watch and laugh away at, and that my mum liked. But never the twain would meet, you know what I mean? You had to keep it separate. You can't suddenly have like a fun bit in the news or something like that. But then the Beatles were like somewhere in between, because they weren't comedians and they weren't straights. They were just these weird guys who had a twinkle in their eye. And I like that deadpan delivery. You didn't really get that deadpan comic delivery anywhere else that I was aware of.
Yeah.
So I was fond of them almost instantly. And then when it's paired with animation and things like on Yellow Submarine, it was like, yep, I'm on board. Love it. And Nowhere Man was the song that really got me.
Yeah.
I liked Eleanor Rigby. It was obviously good, but it was a bit too dark and frightening. Yeah. And it was a vision of something that my parents had always tried to protect me from, which was the grimness of the adult world, the real world. Like the idea that life could be lonely and hopeless and you would be, no one would miss you when you were gone, you know, and all this kind of stuff. It was like, oh, fuck. Yeah. I don't like the sound of that. But Nowhere Man was a more palatable version of that.
Yeah. Slightly more upbeat.
Yeah.
In the Ramble book, you talk, I mean, so much of it's based on music and the popular culture at the time. Do you remember how, I'm sort of really interested in this. We ask guests a lot about this, but can you remember how the Beatles were thought of in the 80s? You know, like whether they were cool or whether they were uncool or whether, you know.
I don't know what other people thought. I guess my impression of them was filtered through my friend Patrick, and he and his brother were mega fans. So to me, they just seemed like old people music.
Mm.
And I just thought, well, this is stuff from another age. I was into everything that was in the charts at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, Gary Numan and Depeche Mode, and I liked Kraftwerk as well, who had a hit with The Model and Computer Love around that time. So I liked all that stuff, and I liked electronic sounds and synthesizers, and I didn't hear any of that in the Beatles, and I didn't really like guitar music that much at that point.
Yeah.
But then I do remember Stars on 45. Do you remember that?
Okay, yeah.
So it was a weird blip in chart history where I don't know what it was. It's like a time at which you were allowed to chop up original versions. I think I'm right in saying, aren't I?
Hello, Jack from the future here. Just to clear up, the Dutch novelty act Stars on 45's Beatles medley that hit the charts in 1981 was in fact recorded with soundalikes. John Lennon's parts were sung by Baz Moyes of the 1970s Dutch pop group Smile, whereas Paul McCartney and George Harrison's parts were sung by Sandy Coast. Back to the podcast.
It was the original Beatles songs chopped up and then married to a beat, like a sort of disco beat almost. And it was a compilation of all like brilliant Beatles songs to this disco beat. I don't know. Was that an official Apple product? It must have been, right, to license those tracks?
I don't think so. I think it was probably sort of a prototype Paul's Boutique-y type mashup thing before.
That's very generous to compare it to Paul's Boutique. Generous.
But, you know, in the same way that Paul's Boutique, they never cleared any of those Beatles samples because people never really thought about that as being a thing.
I mean, it's, I guess, Jive Bunny. I remember Jive Bunny. I think I was a bit young for Stars of 45.
Yeah.
But Jive Bunny must have been a similar thing where maybe you're just using such small clips of the songs.
I haven't listened to it recently, so it's possible that they were soundalikes, because I do remember that they were joined together by not the Beatles singing, those stars on 45, we got to keep those songs alive, like we can work it out, so come on, twist and shout, and all this kind of thing. You know, it was like a song about how great the Beatles were. But anyway, I liked it and I thought, yep, up for that. That sounds pretty good. I like those little snatches of songs. And then maybe, I'm probably twisting all this up, But soon afterwards, maybe even off the back of the success of those, they started re-releasing the early Beatles singles. And I remember listening to Radio 1 one afternoon, and they played, you know, the first one. What's it called?
Love Me Do.
Love Me Do.
Love Me Do. And it sounded like it sounded so old that it was cool. It was like, wow, that's a funny gimmick. Who made this? Cave people? It's ancient, and it's got all these funny, weird non-synthesizer sounds, and it just sounded so basic that it was quite catchy. To me, it sounded a bit like Trio, who did a song called Da Da Da. Do you remember that? Da da da, do 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 do, da da da. These German guys, and they had a little Casio VL tone and did a very basic beat on it and did this super stripped down song. And to me, that's what Love Me Do sounded like. But I liked it.
So the general consensus now, and the way that, you know, people like Rob Sheffield write about it or whatever, is that the 80s, they were kind of at their reputational nadir, and that there was something, I guess, almost kitsch about them, I suppose.
Yeah.
And probably what fueled the kind of quite knee-jerky reactions to a lot of Paul's kind of 80s stuff. So their cultural currency was at an all-time low, which is very, I mean, I feel at the moment we're very much in a peak and it kind of goes up and down. But that's interesting that it was sort of, because when I first got into, I remember hearing synthesizers on Abbey Road and thinking, I can't believe there were synthesizers in that era.
So you've got the Moog on, you've got that white noise wash on I Want You, She's So Heavy. Mm. Where else have you got synthesizers there?
The Here Comes the Sun.
Oh, yeah.
Something, yeah. That's very Moogy.
Yeah. And Maxwell Silverhammer.
Yeah.
Right.
Did you have a Beatles phase? I mean, one of your podcasts where you talk to Louis Theroux and you play your fantastic version of How Do You Sleep, which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Oh, yeah.
But you talk about like the Beatles kind of being something you got into kind of as a teenager, then maybe a bit later. Did you have a kind of phase when you got into them?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Went through all the albums and everything.
Yeah. I think maybe I'd run out of Bowie.
Right.
I was about 18. So after I left school, I don't think I was ever properly into them when we were at school. It was just Bowie and the Doors and then quite quickly segued to Pixies and things like that towards the end of the 80s. But then I can't remember what it was that clicked. But I think one of the first records I got might have been the White Album. When I was working in a restaurant, I was a busboy clearing tables in a pizza restaurant, and it was the first job I'd ever had, and I was suddenly exposed to all kinds of different influences and people from different backgrounds and different ages and races, and it was great. I really loved it. Like, before then, I'd just been in, you know, everyone had been like me, more or less, in the schools that I'd been to. But I really, really liked being in this different environment, but I kind of went a bit nuts, I think, and I started drinking booze really, really in earnest, and I started going out with a server at the restaurant who was quite a bit older than me and who I'm pretty sure had a drink problem now that I look back on it, and it was quite a fraught relationship. It was a weird chapter in my life, very intense. And the soundtrack to those months was the Beatles, was getting into the Beatles and kind of buying a new Beatles LP more or less every couple of weeks and blazing through it. And the one I really remember, though, was the White Album. That was the soundtrack to the darkest part of that period.
Right.
When I really felt like I was losing my shit. And that music almost, I don't know, it seemed to sum up where I was, like especially Happiness is a Warm Gun.
Mm-hmm.
I almost get flashbacks when I hear that still.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Just sitting on a park bench in the middle of the night just thinking, what the fuck is going on? And, you know, the whole, I need a fix because I'm going down, that section really, really evokes a strong feeling of madness and worry.
Right.
Yeah.
For me.
I need a fix because I'm going down, down to the bits that I left uptown. I need a fix because I'm going down.
It's quite scary, scary stuff.
Yeah. It was really dark. But I didn't really, and also I didn't really like the rest of the record. Like, there was lots of good stuff on there. I loved that. And I loved Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except for Me and My Monkey. That cheered me up. Like, that was a funny one. The bit at the end when they just freak out. What are they doing? They're hitting cowbells there or something?
It's ringing a bell, isn't it? This is ringing a bell, but I think they were ringing a bell. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a fire alarm or something.
Yeah.
I just imagine them all hanging off the back of a fire engine and hammering on, like Trumpton, bashing this bell. And it really made me laugh. I thought that was pretty funny stuff. But I really liked the early ones, though, the early records. And I think probably, like a lot of people, ended up listening most to Rubber Soul.
Mm-hmm.
I liked Revolver. That was definitely good and much more like an indie record. I mean, it was almost indistinguishable from a lot of the indie music that I was listening to at the time. The modern, you know, Pixies stuff, to me, it felt of a piece and not dated in any way. But Rubber Soul sounded a bit older, but just the songs were so good. Every single one, it was like, yep, this is good. And also, they were quite easy to sing along with, you know. And you didn't, it wasn't totally impossible to make a decent fist of singing along with them and sounding quite good. And I loved every single song on that one. And I remember me and Joe Cornish used to do a thing on our TV show called Vinyl Justice, and we'd go around to people's houses and look through their record collections and pick out the most embarrassing ones and tease them. And we were in Los Angeles doing a couple, and we went around to Ray Manzarek's house.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Doors keyboard player when he was alive. And I remember him, he didn't really have too many really embarrassing records.
Earth, Wind and Fire and Axis Boulder's Love, I remember from that one.
Oh, really? Holy
that
shit.
I was big Adam Joe fan when I was...
Oh, wow, that's cool.
The first video. And that was my particularly favourite, because I used to have a poster of Axis Boulder's Love, and every time I looked at it, it would remind me of Ray Manzarek going like, Vinyl Man, whatever he says.
Wow. But that's cool that you remember which records he has, and you remember accurately because he only had cool records. I mean, he just had sort of great records from the 60s, kind of thing. There was no, you know, we were always hoping to find the Chuckle Brothers or whoever the equivalent was.
I remember, was it Frank Black just had Buzzcocks, like just hundreds of Buzzcocks CDs? It was all, virtually the whole thing he had, wasn't it?
He had a very neat little wallet of a very good music. I mean, he had Donovan, and he had a lot of Ramones, Buzzcocks, things like that. But Ray Manzarek, it was all classic 60s rock. And we were thinking, God, this is going to be a boring one. And also he was a little bit tricky and kept on correcting us on the pronunciation of his name and things like that. It's that's what we said. Manzarek. Anyway,
I've got a Beatles album. I've got one of the the original Sergeant Peppers.
I think you got it up here. If I remember correctly,
I could find the goddamn thing.
You got Rubber Soul here.
Rubber Soul. There you go. Sorry. Oh, this. Let me tell you about this one. This is the one.
Yeah.
When I realized that the Beatles, see, when the Beatles first came out, this is before your time, you chaps are quite young, so you probably don't know this, but the Beatles were a teeny bopper band.
Yeah, yeah.
They were considered, you know, kind of for teenage girls, yeah. You know. She loves you, yeah, yeah. I mean, quite frankly, it wasn't Miles Davis or John Coltrane. And then I saw this album cover.
Yeah.
And I happened to be myself on a psychedelic substance.
While you saw it, the first time you saw it?
The first time somebody showed it to me, they said we went over to someone's house, and I'm just going, whoa, whoa. I'm doing that Jim Morrison thing.
Yeah.
Whoa. See, we did do that on, whoa, that thing. Do the Morrison, do the Val Kilmer. We did that on acid. And they said, hey, we've got the new Beatles album. And I said, oh, new Beatles album, man, let me see it. And they showed me this, and I went, boing, because you could look into their eyes, John Lennon looking at you, and you knew that this was no longer a child. These weren't teeny boppers. These weren't guys making music for teeny boppers. These fellows had all ingested LSD. I knew it. I looked at them, and I said, these are now acid heads. And turned the record over and started looking at some of the songs. I've just seen a face, of course. And I'm looking through you. When I heard I'm looking through you.
Right.
LSD. I'm looking through you. Where did you go? I thought I knew you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
What did I know? And Girl, did you, when you first heard Girl, did you hear the hidden dirty references to tits?
No, I can't say that I did.
You can hear it. The backing vocals are going tit, 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 tit.
Well, you know who that is. That's this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's Lennon. That's Lennon, the sex maniac. Yeah.
Did you ever bump into the Beatles on your travels?
Yeah. Paul's a nice chap, and George is very spiritual, and Ringo's very funny, and John was an absolute great wit. What an intellectual. He was fantastic. So there's our fantastic Rubber Soul.
Yeah.
And,
that's pretty legal. There's nothing problematic on there.
It is so great, that record. Nowhere Man is on there, isn't it? So I loved Nowhere Man. If I Needed Someone, what might be one of my favorite Beatles songs, I think.
Great.
Drive My Car is a hoot. In My Life, of course, is agonizingly poignant and brilliant, even after. Who did the version on the crappy album with, the one with... was that even Robin Williams who did In My Life on that record?
I think he did Come Together, Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I'll tell you who did In My Life. Sean Connery.
Oh, yes, yeah. God. It's like a sort of, William Shatner-esque kind of...
Exactly right.
Word thing, yeah.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed. Some forever, not for better. Some have gone, but some remain. It was like that.
Yeah, it's definitely a one-take reading of it. Can I go now?
Yeah, exactly.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
As a massive Doors fan, were you quite intimidated about meeting a hero?
I was not too intimidated by Ray, because I never had that kind of personal identification with the Doors at all. It was always about the music. You know, there's certain bits of music that I never really cared about the people who were making it. I thought Morrison was interesting, but he seemed like a bit of a dickhead. And the people who used to really love him were just massive bellends.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would, there's always a guy who would carry around a copy of No One Here Gets Out Alive and just shit on about Jim and think that they clearly thought they were a bit like Jim Morrison, and they were all kind of, you know, they'd sort of drawl a lot and stare off into the distance and refuse to tuck their shirts in. And I thought that they were posers, but I loved the music. Van Morrison, similarly, clearly he was not someone that wanted to be friends with you, and if you had any sense, you didn't want to be friends with him either. But the music was like, oh my god, this is amazing. I love it. So I wasn't too worried about Ray Manzarek. I was pretty nervous to meet Frank Black because I was a big Pixies fan by that point, and he was a little more my age, and also he was still, the Pixies had broken up by that point, they hadn't reformed, but I loved his solo stuff as well, so I was definitely nervous when I met Frank Black.
And how did it come about when your dad did the video?
Oh yeah, that was amazing. So after we'd done Vinyl Justice with Frank Black, he got in touch via his then manager, a guy called Ken Goes, who was he used to manage the Pixies as well, and he was old school hard ass, I believe is the phrase. He was tough. And he didn't take any shit. And so he very charmlessly inquired as to whether we'd be interested in making a music video for Frank Black and the Catholics track Doggone, because they were touring and Frank wasn't into being in the video. So he said, like, yeah, do you want to do a video? There's no money. Frank says that, well, Charles is his real name. Charles said that maybe you'd do it. So we're like, yeah, sure, great. And Joe came up with the idea of, well, originally the idea was that Frank Black would be like E.T. in a shed. And we'd be trying to get him out of the shed by feeding him Smarties. And it was quite a nice idea anyway. But we found out that Frank Black wasn't available. He's on tour. So instead, we thought, okay, let's use my dad. And who was then in his mid-70s, maybe late-70s even, but he was always up for helping us out with anything, and he was part of the show, the Adam and Joe show. So we got him to be like a sort of crazy old street preacher guy, the kind of person that you still see outside Brixton Tube and places like that, you know. And he had a sandwich board that we made for him saying, the end is nigh, and I am here on one side, and the end is nigh on the other side. I am here was one of the lyrics from the track, and we got him to go around London, like handing out flyers with Frank Black's face on them to people in the street, in between lip syncing with some of the words to the song. And we did it guerrilla style, you know, like just going up to random people, some of whom were quite rude. And told my dad to fuck off. But then others were really sweet.
Yeah.
And like buskers and people out on the streets, maybe homeless people and some people outside Brixton Tube. And we got some really lovely reactions to my dad. And it worked out great. And I think Frank Black was really pleased with it because he liked my dad.
Yeah,
they met once and they spent an hour or so. Like, we were filming them for the show because we thought, well, for me, it was just an opportunity to meet Frank Black.
Yeah.
And we were thinking, well, maybe this will be a new segment for my dad. Like, he interviews indie rock legends. But it didn't really work out. In the end, they just chatted about cognac and their favorite roads in France. And it was a bit too Daily Telegraph, really.
That's so good. Yeah. So, I mean, your dad's such, I was such a big fan of Bad Dad and everything. And you talked a bit there about earlier about him listening to Sgt. Pepper. He was a slightly older generation to the Beatles. So did he kind of think of them in the same kind of critical way that he did modern acts like Radiohead that he reviewed on the show? Or did he recognise how good the Beatles were, you know, despite being a bit older?
No, he thought it was all crap.
Right.
He thought it was all absolute crap.
Really?
They were, you know, they were long-haired yobs as far as he was concerned.
Yeah.
He bundled them in with everybody else.
Yeah.
He didn't see the charm in them. He wasn't interested in the songs because to him it was like, it's those druggy weirdos.
Right.
They are, they're the, you know, the figureheads of a culture that has become totally corrupted and... it's the end of civilization, as far as he was concerned.
Absolutely no redeeming features at all. The trumpet solo.
No, not really.
No.
He, you know, like occasionally, I've got a couple of memories of him really struggling to be positive about things that I loved.
Yeah.
Like Bowie, and but he just couldn't manage it.
Mm.
Like he came in one day, and I was listening to Transformer, and I must have been about 10 or 11 or something. I was in my room and I just got Transformer. I loved it by Lou Reed, that is. And I was drawing a picture of, I was copying the cover of Transformer.
Mm.
And then I wrote at the bottom, I thought, well, I'm going to give this a title, this brilliant artwork. And I wrote at the bottom, Lou Reed, Vicious. That was the title of my portrait. And then my dad came in and he looked at the picture and he said, oh, that's a very, very good picture of a very creepy looking man. What does Lou Reed Vicious mean? I said, well, the guy is called Lou Reed and he's got a song called Vicious. And to my dad, it just didn't make any sense. Like, why would you do a song called Vicious? Music is supposed to be uplifting and edifying. It's supposed to appeal to the higher emotions.
Yeah.
Why would you want to drag everything down into the gutter and celebrate an entirely negative feeling, a negative quality, like being vicious? And he said, oh, it's all very sinister, and just left the room.
That's so funny, because I'm so interested in my dad's no longer with us, but he was born in 1945 and loved the Beatles. But it's just anything, any records post-1970, he just didn't get pop and in terms of like Bowie, you know, glam, punk, just absolutely not for him. So, and it's so weird because you sort of try and think, well, punk was just a bit like rock and roll, really. It's just, but like, you know, it's just, it didn't work for him. It's kind of really interesting. I was always interested in that. Whereas the Beatles were, he could fit them in, you know, he could see how good the songs were and how there were elements of folk and elements of classical music that he could respond to. But it was a really interesting generational divide, I think. My mum's the same, actually. Yeah.
My dad's probably somewhere in between. He's 1941 and he has a begrudging appreciation for the Beatles, but he cannot abide anything that I grew up listening to. His thing was always like, but you can't whistle it, can you? It's like, well, maybe that shouldn't be the seal of approval for...
Yeah.
It's so short-sighted, though. That's the thing I always think with my dad is like, you're a clever guy. He's way more well-read and intelligent and lived a more interesting life than I certainly have up to this point. And yet he just couldn't see past the haircuts and the sound, the general sound. It just repelled him. And it was like, mate, you like Glenn Miller. This is Glenn Miller. It's just different instrumentation. You know, you're into the songs, right? The tunes.
And the other weird thing as well is that, I don't know about your fathers, but my dad could listen to some pretty heavy-going classical music when he wanted to.
Right.
Like you know, War Requiem by Benjamin Britten or whatever. And that's not an easy listen, you know.
It's that anti-establishment thing, I think, that was for my dad. He similarly couldn't overcome it. But, you know, he loved the sort of... He was a big, you know, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Glenn Miller...
Right.
And he always liked the sort of edgy, you know, his favorite song ever is Caravan, which is one of the more sort of, you know, discordant Ellington tracks. And it's actually like really weird. You could see it as being a real precursor to sort of like bebop and something, but there's a very, very fine line. He likes sort of Dizzy Gillespie, anything after that is like stupid nonsense. So I think it has a lot to do with just what age you are and what your sort of cutoff point is.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's such a big part of music is the emotional associations. Mm. And it's very difficult to be objective sometimes.
But talking about the generational thing, I mean, you've talked on your podcast and written about it, kind of, you've got a teenage son and you've kind of, you've talked a lot about kind of being in the car with him and introducing him to songs and music and things. And one of those was, you know, I Want You, She's So Heavy and everything. And said now that he's a huge Beatles fan. So how does it work for sort of being the father figure?
The father. Well, it is great in some ways. That was a real watershed moment. And in fact, he even mentioned it out of the blue the other day when we were talking about the Beatles. He was like, oh yeah, do you remember when you played me that song? I always remember that. It was like, it was a real moment. We both knew this is the baton is being handed across to another generation. There's part of me that feels a bit guilty because I sort of think my job as a dad is just to cut ties and let them go and off you go. You make your own life. You find your own influences. But at the same time, a big part of what made me want to be a father was like communing with them and enthusing with them about some of this stuff. Mm. So it is really gratifying. I mean, I think he's pretty good, actually. He's into, you know, he spent ages and ages listening to modern stuff and he loves MF Doom and Tyler, the Creator, and all that stuff. But he's going through a jag at the moment of going quite retro, a lot of Doors. And actually, I think I Want You, She's So Heavy was one of the first Beatles songs he heard. And it was so great listening to it in the car. We cranked it up really loud. And he'd never heard anything like that with that long, long coda, that repeating riff that gets more and more intense. And then the white noise and then suddenly the cutoff at the end of it. I mean, it's such an amazing piece of music, I think. Mm. And so far ahead of its time, I think, when it was made. That's like noise rock, you know, and there's everything in there. There's the old, there's like history, there's the blues, and then there's a window onto the future and kind of weird abstract musical expressionism and fucking hell, it's amazing. And he got it, you know, and it was so exciting being there in the car when he heard it for the first time and he got it and he was like, wow, that was great. And he's not, no disrespect to him, I love him very much, but he's not the most expressive guy. And, but after that, he was like, wow, yeah, that was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. So it was good.
What a great moment. Have you heard the version on that they did at Trident?
Maybe I have.
It's like it goes on even longer and it gets even more mad and Billy Preston really leans into it. Mm-hmm. And the Hammond playing on it and stuff is absolutely incredible.
I've heard one where there's some amazing Hammond stuff. Maybe that's the one. I also heard a little outtake, a studio outtake, with someone coming into the room and saying, would it be a problem if you just turned it down a little bit for the next take?
That's the same.
There's been a complaint.
A complaint. Amazing.
My boys are ready to go.
John?
Yes? What?
Is it possible without affecting yourselves too much to turn down a little? Apparently it's been a complaint.
From who?
From somebody outside the building.
What are they doing here at this time of night? We'll try it once more at the very loud, and then if we don't get it, we'll try it quiet like it might do it the other way. Okay. The loud one, last go. Last chance to be loud. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
We've got to ask you about interviewing Paul a couple of years ago, and I'm sure every single one of our listeners would have heard that interview. And it was incredible. It comes up a lot on this podcast. And because it's a side of him that I think you managed to get out of him that's quite rarely seen of him, sort of guard down and not being too performative. And yeah, it's such an amazing interview. But what was it like? How did it come about, and what was the sort of emotional build up to it?
Yes, I mean, it was a weird one because I was in touch with the PR company that he employs, who are called Doorbell, and I think they're quite good and innovative in that they have slightly counterintuitive strategies for someone like him, because for ages and ages, the Beatles were just sort of in aspic, you know what I mean? Mm. And you didn't really hear their songs that much. And there was a real danger that a whole generation were just not going to know about the Beatles. Even now, when you go on Spotify, the top Beatles songs on there, what are they?
I think it's Here Comes the Sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. And Here Comes the Sun, number one. Let It Be, number two. Come Together, number three. Yesterday, number four. Hey Jude, number five. Mm. Now, look, I don't want to start a fight. They're all great songs. None of them are my favorite Beatles songs.
Mm. I think that's swayed by Abbey Road. It was a huge, huge seller in America.
Right. There you go. But even that is not, it's not past the billion. You're still, Here Comes the Sun is still on 729 million. So it's respectable. Yeah. They're going to be happy with that. But it's not past the billion, which a lot of modern artists are. Anyway, they got in touch with me and said, you know, would you ever be up for talking to Sir Paul? I was like, yes. And that conversation rumbled on for years and years.
Oh, right.
And it didn't look as if it was going to happen. Mm. They'd dangle the carrot every now and then when he had a new record or there was a reissue or whatever. But then in the lockdown, it all just clicked and McCartney 3 was announced and they got in touch and sent me an advance copy and said, look, I think this is going to happen and it'll obviously be remote. And actually, I think that probably did me a bit of a favor because the whole remote thing before that, they wouldn't probably have considered it. I think big stars, certainly pre-COVID, avoided all that because it's such a shag technically, you know, and there's so many things that can go wrong. And anyway, so the stars aligned and suddenly it was like, okay, it's on. And then I was like, oh shit, now I'm actually going to have to talk to this guy. And I was aware that I was stepping into this arena that is sometimes a little crazy with super passionate fans who can get very easily triggered if you say the wrong thing. Mm. And I didn't necessarily want to go in there and just be dealing with Beatle fury for the next few months if I asked the wrong thing or made it clear that I was a little ignorant. Because I wasn't, you know, because I don't have encyclopedic knowledge of the Beatles at all. I just think they're good.
Yeah.
You know? Mm. And certainly don't know every nook and cranny of Sir Paul's career, but it was fine. And I guess I thought, well, this has just got to be worth a try. Probably what's going to happen is I'll get, you know, I listened to quite a few interviews with him before I talked to him and realized fairly quickly, oh, okay. He's like a stand-up comedian. He's got a set of stories that he tells. He's been asked all these questions a million times. He is, you know, aware that there's nothing to be gained really from being candid at this point, from telling people something that he's never told anyone. Why would you, you know? Mm. Instead, he's just spinning the same stories slightly differently, depending on what situation he's in. And actually, the thing that was good for me was getting friends of mine to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And it was a writer friend called Nina Stibbe who sent me a question, which was just like, what's his favorite food? And it was so, I think it was because it was so banal,
yeah.
But universal, you know, it's the kind of question that they ask in smash hits or whatever.
Yeah.
You wouldn't ask Paul McCartney, what's your favorite food? It's like, that's Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'll give it a go. I'll just see what he thinks about these questions that some of my friends have sent in. You know, Alex Horn asked him a question about, what do you read at night or what do you like? What's the last thing you think about at night? And someone else asked about what TV he was into, and maybe I asked that. I can't remember, but those kind of banal questions that maybe you wouldn't think of asking someone like Paul McCartney actually ended up being quite good and set him off on a slightly more personal tack than perhaps he would have done otherwise.
And
you know, those are universal things, aren't they? So he talked about his Marmite and hummus bagel, which was actually a tidbit that I'd got from an NME article I read. So it was good. When I realized he was up for talking about those things and being fine about it and not rolling his eyes and going, ah, Jesus, who the fuck is this guy that I've got to talk to? Then I started to relax a little bit and enjoy myself. But there were still a lot of questions that I wanted to ask, which I was aware that he probably would have been asked 1,000 times, but I just wanted to have them answered on my podcast kind of thing. You know what I mean? About obvious stuff, like about Paul is dead and about his relationship with John. You know, I don't think I got anything that he hasn't said before about that, but it was just amazing hearing him say it to me. Yeah. And also I was very impressed by him. The thing that really struck me was how sanguine he is about the whole business of being in the Beatles, being this person whose whole life has been scrutinized to this crazy degree. He's lost his privacy, really. He's lost his best friend because of crazy fans. He's had a strange life. Obviously, he's had a life that has been amazing and exciting in many ways and full of privileges that many of us would only dream of. But also, like, a lot of intense, scary, horrible stuff as well to have that sort of life. And actually, he's really upbeat about it and philosophical. And I was impressed as well with him just saying, like, you know, I was asking him what it was like living through times in the 60s that must have felt totally apocalyptic. You know, like, people are, especially in the last couple of years, a lot of people kind of say, oh, well, you know, happy end times kind of thing. Hope you're enjoying the apocalypse and all this kind of stuff. But then you think, like, yeah, all right, there's a lot of grim stuff going on, but does it compare to what it must have been like in the 60s with race riots there that were incredibly vicious and horrible, with cops killing people on university campuses and brutalizing people of color the entire time in a sort of totally outrageous way? And, you know, Kennedy being shot and Vietnam and all these people that were assassinated, Martin Luther King being assassinated, all these kind of things, like, just piling up. Like, every month it seemed like there was some new, beyond horrific, appalling end times thing that would happen. And yet he was like, yeah, well, you know, you sort of, it's not like he was brushing it off. He was just saying, yeah, but it wasn't every day.
Yeah.
And it was just nice to get his perspective on it, because he'd written a song on McCartney 3, I think, about that, really, about people sort of going like, oh, my God, we're all fucked. And him saying, well, probably not, you know.
I think basically what everyone wants to know when they hear McCartney being interviewed is basically, what's it like being Paul McCartney? You know, and because when we saw him at the Royal Festival Hall the other week, Samira Ahmed, I can't remember what she was chairing the conversation, but I can't remember what the question was, but he started talking about maybe a grandson of his or someone in his family was at school and was doing an essay about the 60s and the kind of social upheavals and the cultural kind of revolutions that were happening. And Paul McCartney said, so I spoke to him, and like, everyone sort of laughed, and he's sort of like, why are you laughing? But it's like, everyone's laughing because, like, well, because that was you. You caused that, you know? And that's the thing where it's like, you know, to have that, live a personal life, but also to have been basically responsible for basically representing what the 60s was, you know, is so unimaginable, you know?
That's right.
But like,
yeah. to be one of the key players. I know, it's so weird. And yet he didn't act as if he felt like that. You know, he was like, well, yeah, we were backstage. Mm. We're going to do a show and we heard Kennedy had been shot. And, you know, it was really... But they just felt like, well, they were in their own little bubble and they were just getting on with what they had to do. So you get the impression that he didn't really feel, you know, they didn't feel part of, we're history making culture shapers at all.
But that's a great thing you said about the interviews, the questions he does respond to kind of tend to be the more normal, everyday kind of questions. And I thought that it makes me think of, because you mentioned before about the film Two of Us. And I started watching a bit of it after you emailed. And the thing that's kind of interesting about that film, which is about Paul and John meeting in about 1976, Paul visited John in New York, and it's kind of a fictionalized account of what might have happened that day. But the funny thing about the two of them is that they're always talking in kind of real profundities, whereas what would have actually happened was it would have been about hummus and bagels, you know, or something like that, you know. What do you think of that film, Adam?
I like it a lot, and I think I came across it one evening. I was away from home, and there was, you know, I'd just done a show or something. I went back to my hotel room and just wanted to watch something stupid. And maybe I was on a jag of watching a lot of Beatles interviews, and I'd listened to a really interesting interview with George Harrison. Have you heard him being interviewed by Howard Smith?
Is that an American chat show host?
No, he's a radio host, WABC-FM in New York City, this DJ Howard Smith. And I think you can still buy the audio if you search for Howard Smith. And he interviewed all sorts of rock luminaries, and he did a couple of interviews with Lennon and with Yoko, and there's one he does with George Harrison in May 1970, and it is really strange because Harrison is totally straight and open, and he's just answering every single question in a way that you couldn't conceive of someone doing now, even if they're just promoting some boring Marvel film. You know what I mean? They're going to be all cagey and, oh, no, I don't want to do any spoilers, and I don't want to say anything bitchy about any of the cast, and I don't want to imply that maybe the film is a little bit boring and shit or anything like that. You know, everyone has just got to keep it totally on message and airtight, and you wouldn't even think about asking someone about their financial arrangements but he's totally candid about it. Anyway, so I was listening to that interview and watching John Lennon interviews. And then I came across this film, which actually I think they've removed from YouTube now, but you can still see clips. Mm. And it's called Two of Us. And it is, as you say, about Lennon and McCartney coming together. And who is in it? It is Jared Harris, who, of course, was in Mad Men and Chernobyl. And who's the other guy?
Aidan Quinn.
Aidan Quinn, exactly.
Yeah. With a slightly ropey Liverpudlian accent.
Yeah, some of the accents are a bit Taffin-esque at times.
Sure, absolutely. But not too bad. Yeah. And they're both talented actors. And it's Michael Lindsay Hogg who directed it. And it's from 2000. And Lindsay Hogg directed the videos for Paperback Writer and Rain and Hey Jude and Revolution. So he's part of the kind of...
And made the Let It Be film as well.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And it's really not bad. Like, even though it's got a lot of biopic cliches.
It's the definition of wiggy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dodgy hair pieces going on. But actually, it really gets to the core of that relationship.
It's really...
It's stagey in TV movie, but the writing's really good.
It wrestles with... a lot of kind of interesting double act dynamics. I mean, that's partly, I think, why they were so fascinating, the Beatles, is that Lennon and McCartney were this perfect kind of light and shade combo. And that's what made them so good. But obviously there was more to it than that. But also they were like, especially if you were a boy and a kind of, you know, heterosexual boy, like, most best friend relationships are like that. You know, it's usually a pair of opposites. Mm. One guy is the Paul, the other guy is the darker Lennon. And, you know, you're really close, you love each other. And then maybe in your teenage years, girls become involved. and you feel a real jealousy when suddenly your best mate starts going out with a girl, and it's like, oh no, she's ruined everything. And you know, that seemed to all play out in the relationship between John and Paul, and with the arrival of Yoko and Linda, and the tensions. And so all of this stuff is examined in Two of Us in the film, and in a quite good way, as you say, like, it's all very on the nose in a funny way a lot of the time, but it's really not bad. Like, it does get to the, it gets to the nub of all those things that drive that dynamic. And and I asked Paul about it when I spoke to him on the podcast, sort of wondering if he'd immediately say, oh, either, no, I haven't seen it, or, oh, it's bullshit, you know, it's embarrassing kind of thing. But actually he didn't. He didn't dismiss it out of hand at all. And I got the impression that he had a soft spot for it. And he sort of said, no, I like it because it makes it clear from the top that it's fictionalized. It's, but I think he, I got the impression from him that actually maybe it did come fairly close to some of the things that were going on between him and John, albeit in a very silly theatrical way.
And I think, didn't he particularly sort of point out Aidan Quinn, who played Paul? So to kind of point that out maybe shows that he did think there was something of himself in there, you know. Yeah,
I think so. And one thing I didn't do actually with Paul McCartney was, I transcribed a few lines from one of the scenes in the film, and I had it in my head like, well, if everything's going really well, then maybe I can recreate the scene with Paul McCartney, and I'll be Lennon, and he can be Paul. And so I had this little scene. Why don't you? Should we do it?
Yeah, sure.
Come on, who's going to be Paul?
Jack, do you want to take him?
Yeah, I'll give it a go. I mean,
you do quite a good Paul, don't you?
I mean, it'll be better than Aidan Quinn.
I want you to go hard into the impression. Yeah. I'm going to go hard into John. All right. All right. I have now sent you the exchange.
Yeah, I've got.
Can
the
you see it, Jack?
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. So this is a pivotal moment from the Two of Us, the film from 2000, directed by Michael Lindsay Hogg, and I think it gets to the core, this scene of the dynamic that drives the genius of Lennon and McCartney, starting with Paul.
I think it helps to have some kind of public recognition. Otherwise, how do you know if what you've done is any good?
You're daft, you are. I mean, that's Northern, isn't it?
That's all right.
You're daft, you are. I mean, how many adoring fans do you need to know you're good? You got to say goodbye to mummy and daddy. Otherwise, you're just looking for approval, trying to please because it makes you feel wanted.
What's wrong with that? I like to know.
Well, who are you really if all you're concerned with is making other people happy? This is the worst John Lennon impression in the world.
You need to chew some gum.
Well, I can't make people happy be part of who you are.
Trying to make other people happy is like giving them a blanket and a piece of candy to chew on, you know? You got to stir people up, got to make them uneasy, make them miserable, make them wish they'd never been born. That's the only way they'll wake up and face reality.
And whose reality do you want them to face, John? Yours?
Everybody's in pain, Paul. If you want to do some real good, you got to stop singing silly little love songs, mate.
That was very
applause
good.
For applause.
Very good.
Amazing. But quite good, I think, at just sort of stripping bare the complicated relationship between them and something that I'm sure was real, i.e. Paul's desire to make people happy, to look on the bright side of life, to be an optimist. He'd had and he says himself, you know, that he'd had a kind of luckier, happier childhood than Lennon had. And you know, that dynamic, that's the core of every artistic venture, I think, is like, am I going to be one of these people who wants a happy ending and who thinks that people deserve and need a happy ending and to see something beautiful about life? Or am I going to be the kind of artist that wants to wake people up and who thinks that people need to be reminded that life's a bowl of shite? And it's really you know, they really explore that, I think, in quite a good way in Two of Us.
Yeah, it's such a good exchange.
I think it's better now that we dramatized it.
Yeah, it's much better.
Yeah, yeah.
But I that's so interesting, the idea that Paul is the kind of people pleaser in terms of, and that's why melodically, and you can hear that in the way he writes songs. And John is the kind of one who's, it's more about stirring people up.
Yeah, he wants to antagonize people and give them a slap. Yeah. And Paul wants everyone to be nicey-nicey and... But it's not as simple as that, because that makes it sound insipid, and that makes him sound like a coward. But he wasn't. Mm. You know, he was hard-nosed, obviously, and got what he wanted, and he was perfectly capable of being ruthless. But but he valued sweetness and thought it was a worthwhile part of making art. And so that's why I found the whole "how do you sleep" exchange so interesting. You know, because as far as I'm aware, what sparked it off for John was too many people on RAM, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's pretty paranoid to read that into the lyrics of that song. I mean, it's relatively innocuous and...
Totally innocuous.
A massive overreaction.
Yeah.
I mean, what the line is, too many people preaching practices and... you took your lucky break and broke it in two. I think those were the two offending lines.
Yeah.
And obviously there must have been, there was all sorts of tension underlying that, and the rivalry between Lennon and McCartney creatively, as well as the intervention of Linda and Yoko and the tensions that created. So it's all feeding into it. So just the tiniest dig at John and Yoko with too many people preaching practices or whatever. That's it. Yeah. That the touch paper has been lit. And then you get "How Do You Sleep?", which is just this endless screed of the meanest things he can think of saying, that any one of which would just pierce you right through the heart if you heard it from someone you loved. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, how serious do you think John was being? I mean, that's the kind of...
100% in the moment.
Right.
I don't buy his thing when he sort of backtracks of like, you know, it's really a song about me.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it is, but it's also about him.
Yeah. Well, in the Imagine film, you see them laying the track down, right? And there's one bit where he's saying, he's just being incredibly matter-of-fact and businesslike about getting the song to sound the way he wants it, this incredibly negative song. And he says at one point, it's got to be right. It can't swing. It's a nasty song. You know, he's saying like, you know, this is like a really horrible, hurtful song. So let's try and make that come through in the way we're recording it. It can't be fun. Yeah, yeah. This is not a fun song. This is a song that's going to mortally wound my writing partner and one of my best friends. So let's really make that happen, guys. Come on.
Let's make it as unpleasant as possible.
Yeah.
I did like in your version, my favorite lyric of yours. So on the podcast, you kind of recorded your... you found an unreleased take of it. That's right, isn't it? That's the version. Yeah.
that was my incredibly contrived build-up to being able to play my parody of How Do You Sleep? Yeah.
The lyric, some people think your eyes are like those of a sweet puppy dog, but to me they just look like two giant piles of shit. That was my favourite lyric.
I felt that it was like that. That was more or less the same level that he was operating on with the real lyrics. Sure. Yeah, it's so vicious.
Do you mind if we play that for people who might not have heard it now?
I'd be delighted.
I do not think the cheesy music you make is good. If Stevie Wonder asked you to do a song comparing race relations to a piano keyboard, I bet you would. Some people think your eyes are like those of a sweet puppy dog, but to me they just look like two giant piles of shit.
There you go. Cool. That was good fun. Singing on that. I love that. That's my favorite way of spending some time. Downloading a karaoke version of a song and just going nuts over it.
How did you get the kind of Lennon kind of slapback? Did he take quite a while to get kind of convincing
Lennon
production sound?
Yeah, just a lot of twiddling. I Googled it, first of all, vocal effect on how do you sleep. Sometimes that's all you need to do, and someone's put the answer right there for you. But on this occasion, no, I just had to go through Logic and fiddle with every single setting until I finally got something that sounded similar.
Amazing. Well, I think we can all agree it's better than the original.
But that was another thing, actually, that I was thinking, shall I play this to Paul? Would Paul find this funny? Because I'd had Robbie Williams on my podcast, and I played him a song, a parody I did of a song of his called Rude Box. And it was quite a pointed parody because I wasn't a massive Robbie Williams fan back in the day, certainly not around the time of Rude Box. But, you know, we were having a nice chat. We'd been introduced by John Ronson, the journalist, who'd met Robbie doing some other weird UFO show or something. And it felt a bit dishonest not to tell him that I'd once done this version of Rude Box. And also, I thought that he would take it in good spirit because he's a pretty easygoing guy in that respect. Mm. He's willing to laugh at himself and talk candidly about all sorts of stuff. So in the end, I did play it to him, and he seemed fine, but I've met quite a few people since then who said, oh my God, I just had to turn off when you started playing him that song you did. They said that was the most cringy thing I've ever heard.
Really?
I was like, why? Because they were like, well, I guess the rudeness, it just feels so rude. Right. And confrontational, but that's really not why I did it. No. And anyway, the response to me doing that made me think, probably shouldn't play Paul McCartney the How Do You Sleep?
I remember Mark Radcliffe and Mark Riley used to do this thing on their Radio 1 show where they did parodies of songs, and they did one of John Spencer Blues Explosion.
The Shire Horses.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the Shire Horses, yeah. And they played,
they had
John Spencer Blues Explosion in session, and they played it to them, they absolutely did not get it or like it. Complete silence, you know. It's really funny.
I mean, usually that stuff doesn't work out. It's like Tom Hiddleston doing the De Niro impression next to De Niro on Graham Norton.
Christ.
I mean, De Niro did a pretty good job.
That's one of his best performances of the last 10 years, I think.
Yeah.
Humouring that.
But on the, you know, you're sort of thinking like, and it was perfectly good impression that Hiddleston did. Yeah, I think so. It was fine.
Better than his Man in the Mirror.
But you're sort of thinking, that was definitely a kind of, oh, I think I might have to switch off moment. So that's, I'm glad that I didn't play the thing to Paul McCartney.
Good, yeah. I think it was probably the right decision, but you never know.
I think it probably was, yeah.
One question we ask everyone on the podcast is, do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
Yes, but it's probably one that you've been given before.
That's okay.
They're underrated.
I agree.
Yeah, that's good. And we haven't had that before, but that is...
I really do think that, though.
Yeah.
They are the template for so much good and some bad in modern culture. But they did it all. They innovated before anyone else in so many ways. They got cancelled before anybody got cancelled in the pop world, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
When Lennon said they were bigger than Jesus, and they did it all, and it was all of it stands up. The shit bits are really not that shit, and it's just the gift that keeps giving, and every generation finds something new in it, and it means something different depending on what's going on in the world, and it repays intense scrutiny, and I love it, man. It's great. And you know, when you meet people who say, I'm not fussed, you just think, okay, fair enough, but one day you will be. And you know, you just think, well, fine, but that's a pose, you know, because if you can't find anything in there, then good luck. Before we conclude, I would really like to drag the whole podcast down into the gutter.
Please.
And read a list that I was really fond of coming up with that I put this in the background of a thing I did on the Bug TV show. Bug is this live show where I talk about music videos, and we did a TV version back in 2012. And maybe I worked this in somehow as a quick visual gag. But I always was fond of it, and no one thought it was funny. And it was a thing that I nicked off John Holmes, the comedian, who would do similar things, maybe on Twitter. And it's just scatological Beatles titles. and I've got, this is a fun game that anyone can play at home. Sure. I've got the long and winding turd, brown submarine, twist and... You don't have to respond to any of these if you want. You can sit in silence. I'm just going to read them. All right. Twist and Shite. Dear Pudence. We Can Work It Out. You don't even have to change the title for that one.
That's good, yeah.
Back in the Poo SSR. Poo Bloody, Poo Blada. That's not a good one. Why Don't We Do It in the Road? Again, don't have to change anything. Within You, Without You. Sergeant Pooper's Lonely Farts Club Band. And of course, Black Turd. Black Turd straining in the dead of night. Lovely. Take these laxatives and learn to shite. All this time, I was only waiting for the... I haven't finished the rest of that. Still working on that.
Yeah, that's excellent. That reminds me of there was a pub in Bristol where on the inside of one of the cubicles it has the last film you watched is the name of the poo you've just done, and someone had done the remains of the day, which was, I thought that was quite clever.
It does make me laugh, that stuff. Used to make Joe I'm sure it makes a lot of people cringe, and Joe always hated it when I did stuff like that on the radio show. He thought we were it dragged us down too much, but not for me.
So that was our interview with Adam Buxton.
Great times. Sorry it got so scatological.
I actually don't think we should apologise. No, we should encourage people to send in their own scatological Beatles songs.
Dear Pudence was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a lot more fun to be had there. Yeah. Thank you so much to Adam for coming on. I thoroughly enjoyed that, especially as a sort of lifelong Adam and Joe fan.
Yes, thanks so much, Adam.
And we'll be back. We've got probably one more episode for the year with the brilliant Sean Keaveney, another alumnus of Six Music.
Yep.
We got a fascinating chat with him. It's quite Let It Be heavy as well. So
yeah, I mean, it was just, we felt we recorded it maybe not that long after Let It Be Super Deluxe came out. So there's a lot of chat on that. But it was great. He was so funny. And some fantastic impressions.
Yes, much, much better than my Paul McCartney, I must say. But for now, thank you so much for downloading. And tell your friends about this episode if you wish, if that is your want. And we'll see you with Sean Keaveney next week. Until then...
keep beetling on.
Yes, got it right this week. Superb. KBO.
KBO. Yes.
Yeah, toodles.
Bye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.